Thank you very much. I think also thanks for the opportunity to present. I will speak about some specific questions from our, mostly from our own research, but while I'll do this, I will sort of set some pointers and touch upon points that are of interest to other people in the program, so you will also get some kind of an overview of the kind of topics in a small way. If you look at immunology, I think it's one thing that is really striking to speak to, when speaking to an audience of physicists is that, of course, it is a much, much younger discipline than most of physics. If you go back in history, the realization that there is something like immunity to infection, so you don't contract a contagious disease a second time when you survive it the first time, this has been around for a long time. There are clear reports from antiquity that people understood the significance of this phenomenon. But if you look at immunology as a science, as we study it today, I think it would be fair to say that in its current shape, probably originated in the 1960s and 1970s, when it was realized which were the cell types that were actually responsible for this so-called becoming immune to an infection, and the cell types that actually produced antibodies. Antibodies were known a long way before that. My talk will be mainly not so much about theory in its own right, but rather given the fact that I think the efforts to quantify things in immunology have been going on for some time, but still, I think in many ways, they're still in their infancy. I would also like to speak or more closely focus on the relationship between theory and experiment, and how can theory help in actually interpreting experimental data, and also in the second step, guide experiment, which I think, of course, we know from physics is very important and one of the true successes of physics. But I think in many ways, if you think about quantitative immunology, we should think more about a field in its infancy, although, of course, there are already people who founded it, like Alan, who has gone slightly gray in the last 2 years. Okay, and this actually brings me to the quote I put up here, which many of you may know. I mean, this is from a very entertaining and very delightful exchange of letters between Faraday and Maxwell. And of course, we know that Maxwell was largely self-taught. He was not a good mathematician in any way, but Maxwell, he was also 40 years older than Maxwell, or the other way around, very interesting. And then Maxwell took his results and formulated mathematically, that's history of physics, but I really found this quote very interesting from my own position, and I just read it out. I was at first almost frightened when I saw such mathematical force made to bear upon the subject, and then wondered to see that the subject studied so well. And actually, that's a sentiment that's not unknown to people who work in our field and often work with experimentalists who, of course, have no mathematical training at all, but enormous intuition and enormous gifts in doing fantastic experiments. And okay, with that, let's enter what I'm trying to do today. I would like to start a little bit earlier than immunologists would usually consider immunology. In its sort of more strict sense. I would like to get a few ideas across of how we understand how immune cells actually originate in the immune system, and this is where the stem cell part comes in. And just to give a few numbers, because numbers are always good, it's estimated, and the estimates are pretty good, that a human has about 5 to the 10 to the 13 cells in the body. More than half of those are made by one particular type of stem cell that in the adult sits in the bone marrow. That's called the hematopoietic stem cell, or HSC. And many of them probably are already made during embryonic or fetal development, but more than half of the cells in your body are of hematopoietic nature, and most of these cells are actually erythrocytes, and the reason why the count is so high is because the erythrocytes are so small. But these stem cells. Red blood cells. Okay, so these are actually the most numerous cell type in your body. There's another very interesting estimate, how many cell divisions. So all of these cells are continuously renewed, and we will talk about tissue renewal in this sense, but also in the more stricter sense in the immune system itself, actually. And it's estimated that during an average lifetime, there are about 10 to 16 cell divisions in the urine per human. Okay? That's good. So some of the these estimates have different histories, but I should point out that there's Ron Milon and names suddenly escapes me.
Philip,
yeah, exactly. What's his name? Rob Phillips, exactly. Rob Phillips, thank you. What's his spelling? Is that correct? Thank you. They collected a lot of these numbers, and it's really an important task, I think, in biology. So this number, I would say, is not a particular certain number, but the order of magnitude may be correct. And most of these divisions actually happen in the hematopoietic system. And if you calculate how many cell divisions that means you have per second, that's of the order 10 to the 6. So it's in megahertz. Do you feel it? Divisions per second. Per second. That's roughly 4,000. Anyway, so the large part is the so-called hematopoietic system. And it does many things, but it produces... what's this out here? It produces, in particular, the lymphocytes. So, and lymphocytes are the main agents of adaptive immunity. I'll talk a bit more about them. And they come into two flavors. They're called T cells and B cells. Just sort of time is a bit here. So T and B lymphocytes. Okay. And they have precursor stages that are called... at least in mammals, called thymocytes, because the T cells mature in a special organ, that's the thymus, that's particularly active in young subjects, and B cells actually mature in the bone marrow, and their precursor stage is pre and pro. B cells are just sort of pre-B, and produces these types of cells. And there's been a long question, actually, how they are produced. Are they produced your whole life? How does the system age and so on? We will touch upon a little bit of that. Okay. There's other cell types of the immune system that are often a little forgotten when theoreticians study immunology. And this is because these cells are so fantastically interesting, and we come to this in a second. And these are cells that themselves do not particularly recognize pathogens in a very specific way, but are absolutely needed to defend you against infections. And I would just like to mention two of them. One is called granulocyte. These are small cells that patrol the body. They live in the blood, so this is a major type of white blood cells that you would count in the blood. They are small, and they're about short. They're short-lived, so their lifetime is about a day. There's some controversy what the real lifetime is, and I believe Rob DeBoer also worked on these type of questions. But given that these lifetimes are months to years, they're much shorter lived. And there's other cells, they call them macrophages. These are larger cells, phagocytotic cells. Both are phagocytes. They gobble up small microorganisms. They gobble up infected cells or larger pathogens. And they all come from the hematopoietic stem cell. There's other cells I will not go into that are also very important for the immune system. The cell type is called dendritic cell that present antigen to these types of cells. They're also of hematopoietic origin. There's platelets that are not so important for the immune system, but there's masses of them produced, and there's red blood cells. Exactly. Macrophages have different origins, but they come from monocytes. Thank you. Okay. And many of the macrophages that we have in our immune responses are some of maturation stages of the monocytes, although this is currently a very active field, actually, and a lot of new discoveries are coming out. And granulocytes also come from precursors, and the major layout of the system is in such a way that you have these stem cells in the bone marrow. Just to give some numbers, for the humans, I'm not sure there are good numbers. I didn't find any. For the mouse, there's many numbers that converge in something like 10 to the 4. So you have about 10 to the 4 stem cells in your hematopoietic stem cells in the bone marrow of this order. And then they go through precursor stages that have certain names. And these names, they come from the experiment in which they were described. The next stage is called a short-term hematopoietic stem cell. I'll I'll explain in a second why this is short-term hematopoietic stem cell, at least where the name comes from. There's another cell type that's now currently under a lot of scrutiny experimentally, whether that really is a true progenitor. But let's take it for reasons of the lecture, just this. There are stages of this kind. They're called multipotent progenitors. And what's important here, all of these cell types seem to have potential to produce both what is called the lymphocytes, the lymphoid branch, and what is called down here is called the myeloid branch of the immune system, of the blood forming system. This is called the lymphoid. Okay, if your favorite cell you're working on is not on here, I apologize. I just give the general outline. There's other lymphocytes as well, and so on. Okay.
What did you say the myeloid cells do to assist the...
So these cells are important to basically gobble up things that you don't want in your body. Okay, these cells, they ingest bacteria, for example. These cells can ingest other cells that are infected or that are old and dying. And there's what is clear, however, I think a lot of this is this kind of differentiation tree is under scrutiny at the moment, and that's why I also didn't put these cells in here. Some of them made real problems. These, for example, are very interesting. Traditionally, we think they actually come from monocytes, and they do, but there is a fundamental branching event here in this differentiation tree between what's called the lymphoid branch and the myeloid branch. Again, it's discussed where this happens, but it's clear that it does happen. So from some stage onwards, I should say that, from some stage onwards, there are progenitor cells. They also have names. They're called common lymphoid progenitors. And here they're called often common myeloid progenitors that have lost the potential to produce cells of the other lineage. And if I speak about potential, what I mainly mean is the potential in the bone marrow in the in vivo situation. Of course, we know that we can take any cells of the body and reprogram it into a new stem cell and make other stuff from these stem cells. So it's really what we're asking, what do the cells do in their normal environment? And clearly, this is important to make this point here. What they do in their normal environment is not only an autonomous function, but depends very much on the kind of signals they receive. So here's the split here. And the CMPs are thought to give rise to these different types here. So that's the basic outline. Okay. There's one very important, I'll take a color for this, event in here. So during the lecture, I would like to look at two questions. And the first question is really simple. But the answer, nevertheless, turns out to be, once you ask the question and really try to answer it quantitatively, I believe the answer is actually very informative. And the answer is the following. You have these 10 to the 4 stem cells. This is mouse. And there's some debate what is human. In the mouse.
But the debate varies from what to what?
Yeah, on this order. So actually, there is people don't count this anymore today so well. I mean, that's experiments with radioactive labeling. And so students don't like to do this anymore. It's true. And... maybe 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5, according to my knowledge. So apparently it's not, so the mouse is a lot bigger than factor 10, the human is a lot bigger than factor 10, but the number of stem cells doesn't seem to vary as much, at least that's my take on it from the available numbers. So there are good numbers in different animals. So I think there's numbers in the rat, and there's numbers in canine, and rabbits, and so on, and they're all in disorder. Okay? Right. in the mouse, we have about 10 to the 7, again, maybe it's sometimes 10 to the 8, is of this order, granulocytes, they're short-lived. And the first question I would like to address in the first part of the talk is, if you take a stem cell here and you produce a granulocyte, how long does it take? Okay? Bearing in mind that you need to replace 10 to the 7 every day. Okay, so that's the first part. And the second part really does relate to what most of people in the course actually are studying, namely the adaptive immune system. And the adaptive immune system has a great speciality, which makes it really very interesting. It has a what we call a somatic recombination event that's not happening in any other cells of the human body, where actually genes are reshuffled during the development of these cells. You will know that. And basically, these cells draw from a repertoire of gene segments. When they make the receptors that recognize antigen, draw randomly segments and put them together in a very unreliable way, which produces enormous diversity of the antigen receptors. And they make it both here and also the B cells here. Make it. So there's a somatic recombination of the antigen receptors. I just said, right, antigen receptor recombination. And that's really is a key focus of what people who are on this program are doing. There's interesting aspects of studying this diversity in terms of, say, statistical physics, information theory, but there's also interesting aspects because there's also problems of evolution in here that may happen within an organism itself, especially for B cells. B cells evolve further in terms of diversity. They're selected upon different criteria. They must not be responsive to self. They should respond well to foreign antigens and so on. I will not dwell on this, but this is really highly active, very interesting field. For our purposes, what's important here is that this makes good T cells and good B cells that have already done their job in an infection, and they should be kept by the body and form so-called memory cells. So and you'll write this. If they're good, in some sense, they will form memory. And that memory is what you get if you get vaccinated or if you survive an infection. This type of memory cells cannot be fed from the stem cells anymore because the stem cells will not have the same antigen receptor combination, cannot be directed. So this system here has to have some autonomous function that is different from the system down below. And this, if the time is enough, I will speak about this in the second part of the talk. What are our current ideas? How do memory cells are actually generated? Oh, I already used up most of my time here. No. 15 minutes. Okay. Good. So just let me highlight a few questions, I think, just to span a little bit the range of things that one might be doing in the next years or next decades. So what are problems if you look at this system? So first, one problem, of course, you want to understand the dynamics of this system for many reasons. And that's what I will say a little bit about today. What we also want to understand is, of course, the kind of topology of the different cell types on which the dynamics act. So we also want to understand what we might call lineage topology. So whatever this myeloid branch would be called a lymphoid branch would be called a lymphoid lineage. And one question would be, where's this branch point, for example? So that's, in some sense, a question of topology in a simple way, lineage topology. And we will address this in the second part on T-cell memory. But of course, we also, and a lot of the efforts in the program of people who have worked for a long time in the program are about regulation. How do I regulate to get the right numbers of cells? And a lot is known about T-cells, how T-cells do this, for example. In some sense, a lot more than for the other cell types, because T-cells were cool to study, and they are. So correct numbers. We also want to respond to challenges. We get infections. We get chemotherapy if we respond to challenges. If you have a tumor. And intimately linked with all of these questions, there are questions of understanding disease, disease and also therapy. And I will also just set some pointers to some of the places that are interesting in this respect. So by and large, you may ask, where does this picture come from? And this is very interesting in itself. And the mainstay type of experiment that has led, there's several experimental sources, okay? I cannot be exhaustive for the time that I have here, but the main type of experiment is an experiment where you take one of these cells here and transplant it into a mouse, and then you see what comes of these cells. And for most of the cells that sit in this upper part here, that are called stem and progenitor cells, because they have mass, and these are also progenitors, they have potential, developmental potential, stem cells and progenitors. Progenitor cells. This experiment works only if you kill the endogenous system of the mouse beforehand. So most of these are come so experimentally. This comes from so-called transplantation experiments, or what immunology is sometimes called an adoptive transfer. And sort of to test the developmental potential of these cells in the mouse. The same type of experiments is also done for lymphocytes. For lymphocytes, the treatment isn't quite as severe. You don't need to condition your mouse to give the mouse lymphocytes. So this is a big experimental difference, and I will also try to touch upon this, because we now start to realize that what happens after transplantation in this upper part here in the bone marrow is very, very different, and at least so far, for the aspects that we could look for in our experimental systems, is very different from what happens after transplantation. So transplantation may be a very special situation to study that may be quite distinct from normal functioning of the system. For T cells, this kind of is often called an adoptive transfer. That seems to be a much milder treatment. You don't need to do anything to the mouse beforehand. Okay, so let's look at, let's write an equation, okay. look at this first question here and look at the experiment of how we would like to address this first question. So, but it's always good to do a little bit of theory beforehand to sort of develop expectations from the experiment. And the theory is very simple, of course, in principle. To write down the equations is no effort. You have a reference compartment here, it's called a reference, it has a certain reference cell number. You have a donor or upstream compartment that has a certain upstream cell number. And then the cells do mainly four things. So we want to, for the purpose of the talk, we solidly remain on the level of what the phenotypes of the cells are. We will not look at the underlying molecular regulation, which is a very interesting field in its own right. And the processes that we have is that the cell gives rise to two. It's called this proliferation. And we want to characterize this by a simple rate here. We can do more complex things than this. Cells will change their state. That's called a differentiation. We will also characterize this by a rate. Cells will die at some point. Characterized by rate here. And then cells will also migrate, and that's very important. But for the purpose of the talk, we will not speak explicitly about migration. But that's, again, is a very interesting subject. Of course, there's spatial organization. The system, as you get a feeling here, is highly distributed. There's many different cell types that need to cooperate. There's no central agency that is directing them. And they do it in different places of the body, and they need to get there. So migration is also an important aspect. Yes? Right. So everything that we will do today, we will think of something that's well mixed. But of course, that's again a question. I think if one's fair and lists these kind of questions here, I guess it's, at least it's my personal take, it's fair to say that on many of these, we have some ideas on what could really happen. But I think we are very far from having a good picture of what's really happening, and so many of these things, although there's many hints around, I think there's still questions for research to go on for a long time, I would expect, actually, especially if you want to be quantitative. Of course, I don't need to explain this to this audience here, but typically when we sort of test ideas in the quantitative sense here, we often start to realize that there are contradictions and things don't work as we thought and so on. So I think we're really very much at the beginning of trying to understand that. Okay, so let's do spatially mixed things. It's also a question of timescales, and I will at least be able to give you a hint of what the timescales are. So the basic equation would be just a balance equation where we have the change of cell number. Very simple, we get influx here. Alpha U of cells U, and then cells get out again of the reference compartment. They can die in our reference compartment, or they can, and this is reduced, of course, let's call it lambda, by proliferation. So these kind of balance equations feature very heavily They're simple, it's well mixed population. I'll try to speed up a little bit to get to the second part, where we think that there's also single cell pictures of these that are very interesting in their own right, and this is something we're also just starting to understand. And there's also interesting mathematical questions, I would say, how to relate these single cell pictures to these population pictures, but let's remain on this here. So this is a simple looking equation, but if you really want to study it from a point of view of learning something about the experimental system, it's really, really complex. And the reason is that all these parameters here, alpha, so this is for a whole system, of course, alpha, lambda, and delta, are really functions of the cell densities in the system. And the system is regulated, and there is work in the hematopoietic system on this type of regulation, but if you, and I should mention Michael Mackey here, who has looked at a certain type of hematopoietic malignancies over his entire scientific career, and this is fantastically rich work on these kind of aspects here, but if you go into it, I think that's really, we know relatively little about how this regulation really works. And we certainly know very little in the quantitative sense. The other question here is, if you look at this equation, is a much simpler but also very important question is that, you see, it has a very unpleasant structure in the sense that all these rate constants here, they sum up to some kind of sort of time constant, sort of collective rate constant here. And that actually in practice turns out to be very difficult from an average measurement that has been designed without much thinking about the subject matter to learn anything about the individual processes, and that's simply because they're all proportional to cell number. So there's an identifiability problem for the parameters. Identifiability. So that poses the question, which kind of data are needed to say something about this, and that's certainly also the use of mathematics in the field. Okay.
Can I quickly ask?
Yeah, sure.
Aren't throughout a lifetime all these numbers of cells pretty constant?
So exactly.
The left side should be there.
Perfect. That was my next step. Okay. So in an adult, of course, we think we have a steady state. And as we anyway need the steady state equation at some point, I'll write it down. I probably need a bit of space for the data here. So at least for the blood-forming system, in the adult, you can assume you have a steady state, and let's rewrite this in steady state. We will need the equation as simple as it might be. Let's write in this form here. So minus beta r, and I took a little bit of liberty here. I said we only want to know the net proliferation. We don't want to know cell death precisely. So let's define a new parameter. It simplifies our problem. So of course that's a very useful equation, and we'll use it in a second. So let's now come first to the first question, and of course you would agree asking this question essentially is an experimental question. So we need an experiment, and maybe I should say something here just to be fair. This type of, before we go on, this type of problem of identifiability that has been addressed by a lot of people also in the program in many different contexts. And the question here is to conduct sort of additional measurements, get additional data that are informative on particular rates in this process. And there's a very good literature on trying to understand proliferation and some sense also death rates of lymphocytes, for example. Let me just write T cells here. Dr. Bohr, Becker, many, Alan Paris, and many people have contributed here. So we can actually enrich the experiments. We can tell the experimentalists what they should measure if they want to know some of these rates. And numbers are appearing now. And good numbers are appearing now. And let me just say that has been done for stem cells. Okay, hematopoietic stem cells. The estimates are a little bit diverse in the literature, but more or less they are of the order of our lambda parameter here for stem cells, something like in the normal bone marrow, a stem cell divides once every 50 days. So it's a rather inactive cell, and we'll see more evidence of this in a second. Okay, and this comes from techniques of this kind. One important one is called the so-called VRDU labeling, just write a word down here. And the idea is you supply the cells with a label that is diluted in a division-dependent fashion, and that gives you additional information on how to separate these different rates. Okay. So, but let's, we want to really learn something about differentiation. And to learn about differentiation, an important experiment that you can do is an experiment that's called fate mapping. And I will not explain it, how it's really done experimentally, but it's a rather advanced type of thing. So you cannot come to a lab and say, oh, let's do some fate mapping of this cell or so. So the experimental system, which is a particular transgenic mouse that the data that I will talk about now come from, took 5 years to develop for a graduate student and a postdoc afterwards. So it is not undoable, but it's a reasonable effort, and you need to be very skilled experimentally. And I should mention, because it is an effort, the particular fate mapping of hematopoietic stem cells I'll talk about, it's worked by Hans-Reimer Odewald in my institute. And the postdoc who was perseverant enough to make the mouse was Katrin Busch. And making this mouse 5 years, you have failures alongside. You make a mouse, the mouse doesn't work, and so on. But the principle is very simple. You put a label into the stem cells. So some of the stem cells now are labeled here. Okay. And this label is distinguished from this BRDU type of labeling that I wrote down there by the fact that it's heritable. So the stem cell has the label, and every progeny of the stem cell, be the stem cell or the derived cell, also has the label. Okay. So what you will see with time in the mouse is that you will label stem cells, then the label will pop up in this compartment. But this will be after some delta T. Okay. They will pop up in this compartment, V2 and so on, and eventually it will pop up in this compartment after delta Tn. So that gives you an experimental. Now you have to understand how to analyze the data and so on, but it's very clear that somehow from these types of data you can get this dynamics, this number here. And the interesting problem, however, is because the label is heritable, it's not only passed on through differentiation steps, but the cells also proliferate at the same time. Now this diagram gets messy. Monocytes don't proliferate, they just die. Okay, they're mature cells. Macrophages do proliferate a little bit, some of them. Anyway, so you have these basic processes that you have these differentiation rates and the proliferation rates. And it turns out, however, that this experiment defines all these parameters precisely. Sorry? Yes. This type of experiment that I sketched here defines these parameters rather precisely. And I should point out that the first interesting fact for us when we did this experiment and we looked at the data, you can sort of get now an experimental estimate of these granulocytes, and that answers the question already, and that's about 1 year. Okay. So if I switch on the label in the stem cell, although I need to produce 10 to the 7 granulocytes per day, it takes about 1 year before the label turns up in the granulocytes. And maybe it's not so surprising if you start to think about it, but what does it really mean about the system? And let's try to deduce this from some elementary arguments, and then I'll just make some general remarks on where the theory goes and how you, so we will talk about dynamics here, how you will be able to talk about lineage topology, just to leave time for questions.
So are we born with the 10 to the 7 granulocytes?
Yes.
Oh,
very important, born? Very important question. You can do these fate mapping experiments in the fetus, okay? And in the fetus, it takes some weeks. So fetal dynamics and adult dynamics are fundamentally different for reasons that we do not understand, except, of course, that the fetus needs to establish the system as such. It's a mouse.
What's the generation time of mouse?
In which sense?
Well, so the age at which you have
chicken. So you need about 20, sorry?
About 12 weeks.
12 weeks. So you need about 20 days gestation, 12 weeks until you get kids, so it's pretty rapid.
So that's much shorter than 1 year.
Absolutely. Much, much shorter than 1 year. So what happens in the fetus is fundamentally different from what happens in adult mouse. Adult mouse lives about 2 to 3 years. And if you really think about it, if this is a characteristic time scale of one year, it's the lifetime of the mouse is just barely sufficient to equilibrate the label across the hemophagocytic system.
If you so their expansion of people deplete cells in the periphery.
Right.
Where does that increase the rate?
This is a very interesting question. We're doing this now with this system. I'm happy to talk about it. I think that's where the field is going now. People have done that, but of course you need a good system to monitor what's happening. And the answer seems to be yes and no. You can deplete certain things that feed back to the stem cells, and you can deplete other things that don't feed back to the stem cells. And that's maybe also, you could speculate, that's the way the system was designed. So you get this type of branching structure here that if you want to do something in one branch, you don't need to go back to the source, but you can regulate it within the branch. So, but that's, at the moment, I would say still theory. We don't really know what the experiments will be. Okay, so let's just finish this just because it's very, very simple maths. From these type of experiments, how you get the numbers out, it turns out to be really simple, but it turned out to be very useful for us because we were then able to tell the experimentalists exactly what to measure. Because typically you also find yourself as a theoretician, if you really want to work with data, there's usually some problem with these data that people haven't thought about it beforehand. And the first thing is to realize it's easy to write down these equations here. The numbers themselves are not in principle measurable very well. And the reason is that you can only sample aliquots from the mouse and you have to be sure about the aliquot size and so on. But of course, this is a good measurement. This you can measure by taking a sample from the bone marrow. So that can be measured. The measurement. And the second measurement that's very good is sort of the so-called labeling frequency in the compartment, which is the number of labeled cells divided by the total number of cells in this compartment. And that's, again, something that you can measure by drawing an aliquot. Okay. And that you can, this is three lines of algebra. This evolves according to a differential equation, the simplest you can think of. There's a time scale down here. And it just equilibrates with the labeling frequency in the previous compartment. And that's important, that holds only in steady state. So for non-steady state situations, actually the theory is not so clear. We cannot even give a closed form equation for a non-steady state situation. And it's not so clear what you really should measure. So interesting question. So now, just to demonstrate here, this time scale is the really interesting part of the theory that turns out is the inverse of a difference of two rate constants. And when this is differentiation, and this is proliferation here. Differentiation, proliferation. And so this has an immediate meaning. Because if you look at the compartment, say here, in this compartment. This compartment will produce a number of progeny per unit time. And to do that, it has two sources of this progeny. First of all, it will proliferate cells within the compartment, so self-renewal. Let's call this beta. Let's call it beta and alpha. And what this number is telling you is what's the difference between the what goes out and what's self-produced in this compartment. And if this difference is small, then the compartment needs little input. If the difference is large, the compartment needs a lot of input. And that's really a quantitative way of measuring what biologists call self-renewal. So this is a direct measure of what we would call the degree of self-renewal in the compartment. So we would claim, with this type of measurement, we can quantify what self-renewal in this compartment is. And of course, for a real stem cell, I guess people fail to see that here. For a real stem cell, this would go to infinity because the stem cell compartment doesn't need input. It can sort of replenish itself. But what we find in a second, I'll show that, we have compartments that are nearly self-renewing. So then they have nearly like stem cells. So there seems to be a continuous gradient of this property, nearly self-renewing. Then T would be much larger than, say, a typical time scale for the mouse. And we have compartments that we would call transit, that really depend on input, and the time scale is of the order of one per day or something like this. So all of this is not entirely new in some sense, but the important realization is here we have a tool to measure it, okay? And what comes out of this is that stem cells, as we would expect, do something very rarely. But the number itself is already interesting. It would say that this rate of differentiation, I forgot, there's one simple argument here. So this comes directly from the label propagation. Okay. But you can find out the individual parameters because you have this from the label propagation. In principle, you could insert it here. You have this from the steady state measurement, so you find this thing here. And for every compartment that is not a stem cell, you also have for this U compartment, you have this label propagation measure, so you also find out the beta. Of course, practically, you don't do it like this, but it shows you that these types of measurements, these two types of measurements here, of labeling frequency and the size ratios at steady state, they're sufficient to deduce the differentiation proliferation in all of these compartments. And the result is stem cells very rarely do something once every 100 days. And these numbers have confidence bounds and so on. But remind you, I put there number 1 over 50 days, how fast stem cells proliferate. If these two numbers are correct, that would mean that stem cells actually die very frequently. Okay? So they make a differentiated progeny once every 100 days, but if they need to if they proliferate once every 50 days, that would mean that they replace themselves and vanish at the rate of once 100 days. So they would only have a lifetime of 100 days. We don't know whether this is true, but I think it's showing that we really can bring this sort of quantitative apparatus to bear on real questions of biological significance. No one knows actually how stem cells die in the bone marrow. It's simply difficult to measure.
So you said the difficulty of this equation is that these rates are density dependent. So what density corresponds to that number?
So that's the solution to your question. We are on steady state.
At a certain density.
Exactly.
Density of that. It's like a normal density for adult mice.
That would be the adult mice, of course.
And for the fetus, I suppose that the density differs. That's why you expect to get different rates.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you're also probably not in steady state.
So in the fetus, you're not in steady state. You're building up the system. Density differs. If I start to give a lecture on fetal hematopoiesis, I will take several hours, and it's unsure what we will really have learned about this. So the system in the fetus is very, very complicated. And I think I would also make a point of warning here. It's easy to generalize from these kind of pictures into something, but really we need to understand the experimental picture that's really presented by the mouse to us. And the fetal hematopoiesis is, frankly, saying a mess to some extent. We know many aspects of it, but just to give you one example, we know now, and this is very recent, this is last year, we know now that most of the macrophages that we have in the body that we study during normal immune responses come from these stem cells in the adult, and we see that. But there's a certain population of macrophages that does not come from these stem cells, that comes from the fetus. And what this means is that the hematopoietic cells we have in the adult organism, they can have very disparate sources. So not all the cells that we see necessarily come from this type of cell that we think is the origin.
Sorry, Thomas, you're setting up your own questions at this stage.
Yeah.
So if that was the case, I mean, even with this classical hematopoiesis tree, how dependent are your deductions on that? You know, are they
right.
sensitive to that? Because like, that's a caricature, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
so
even you're saying it's a mixture of fetal and...
Right. So what Ken is just referring to is a really important question. So first of all, let's put it like this. So this experiment has some consistency checks in build. Because first thing is, if you observe a peripheral population that gets the label, we know it has stem cells at its origin. The other question is, does it have separate sources? Okay, that's agreed. But I think for granulocytes, the evidence is quite good that it doesn't. That's why it's one of the examples why we chose granulocytes. Of course, that we have to go into the experimental literature. Okay, but this is also for T and B cells, I think the evidence is quite good that it doesn't. Okay. The other question is, however, that's equally interesting, and I should also say that Ken recently also contributed to this with a very nice paper that uses transgene cell transportation data. What's the actual structure of the tree once I accept that everything I observe does come from the stem cell? And I think my time is running away, and I want to say a few things about this system. But I just want to leave it at this point. This is a very interesting question. And as Ken has shown in a recent paper, and as we have been trying to put forward for T cells, these kind of lineage topology questions, they cannot be answered very well on the level of these population ideas. And single cell based fate mapping experiments, I think, are a very useful tool for doing this. And of course, they will involve some different mathematics in writing this down, these simple population equations.
The objections that you seem relatively insensitive.
Sorry?
I thought you were just going to say they're relatively insensitive argument.
Right, and thank you for giving my answer.
Okay.
So, about the parts that I will speak here, the deductions are robust because we have some kind of sanity checks in here. And this is simply the order at which the label appears in the different compartments. Okay? So just to be more precise, I think this order can be used to deduce some kind of sequence. But this kind of argument fails when you look at branch points. You can easily convince yourself of that. So these population type measurements are good for sequence, but position of branch points remains unclear. A rule of thumb. Okay, stem cells hardly do anything. These cells do something once every month, roughly. These cells do roughly do something once every day. Okay, so there's a real gradient. Bring out some ideas here. There's a real gradient in what I would call activity of the cells. Again, not entirely unexpected, but there's an opposite gradient now. If I take this tau parameter that's defined over there, that we would call degree of self-renewal. And that's a very interesting feature because it means that the more active the cells become, the more dependent they become on input. Okay, the cells that can sort of do everything out of their own, they're not very active, while the cells that can't are active. And you could speculate at this point that maybe this is an organization, as actually also seen in other adult stem cell systems, that protects against malignancy to some extent. And indeed, we know from myeloid leukemias, myelogenous leukemias in the body, that there are different types of myelogenous leukemias. And there is a certain type that's very common, it's called CML, okay? This is myelogenous leukemia, so they produce too many of these cells in the end. And that's chronic, so that's actually something you get. It's only diagnosed at very old age and takes a long time to develop. And the idea is that mutations in these stem cells, one of them, I just mentioned one, it's very famous, it's a fusion protein called BCR-ABL, increase slightly the activity of these already self-renewed cells. There are other leukemias, where the current understanding is, again, I would say far from absolutely sure, that they really transform cells that are further down the line. And what they do here and is that they take these very active cells and in some sense, make the mutations, make them self-renewing, okay? So some are self-renewal is pushed further down into this chain. And interestingly enough, because this is acting on very active cells, these are acute, so they arise very, very quickly. Okay. Let me point out two more things, and then I'll just wrap up with an outlook on this part here. It's probably hard to see already. aging of the system is an important question. But now, of course, there's an interesting question. Is the mouse a good model for aging? A mouse is 2 years of age, and 2.5, and maybe Methuselah mouse, 3 years. Humans, you know, age in a very different way. And there is an idea around in the literature that as the system apparently ages in the mouse, it tends to produce more myeloid cells than lymphoid cells. Okay? Now, we have a real way to quantitate this, and what we find, it always produces more myeloid cells than lymphoid cells, even in very young mice. And aging is not an important factor in this. It's a bit accentuated by aging, but there's a big flux bias of cells into this branch here, and very few cells into this. It's about a ratio of 1 to 100, okay, in terms of production of these different precursors, and it gets a bit accentuated with age. okay, but not much. Okay. This is also, if you understand the system well, is probably also a reflection of the biology of the system in the following sense, and that in this kind of system here, there's this continuous gradient of self-renewal versus activity, and finally you get the differentiated cells. In the lymphoid system, which I unfortunately have no time to go into detail, but there are stages here in this development of lymphocytes that themselves almost look like self-renewal. And that's also something we found out, or that is becoming more and more clear now from experiments of the kind I'm describing here. And in particular, what lymphocytes do in the time is they massively expand. And to some extent, what people haven't thought about before, but the thymus for a long time can actually function autonomously without input from stem cells. It's not perfect, but the thymus is capable of sustaining its own output for quite some time without any stem cell input. So this is a much more complicated setup of the system, and it's probably very much to do with the question of this antigen receptor recombination that the dynamics look so different. One very last comment, and all of this is true. At some point, we knew that from the experiments. There is an obvious experiment you should do, and this is, if this is taking so long, and that really means the stem cells don't really participate, and most of the cell production really comes from these kind of compartments, these kind of so-called short-term stem cells that are defined by transplantation as only short-term functioning, are actually really almost sustained stem cells in the mouse, I should say. This time scale from 1 year is already present here, almost. It's almost already 1 year to go from here to here. So they're almost self-renewing under steady state conditions, which they are not in transplantation. There's a simple experiment. You should take a mouse and kill the stem cells. Okay. And the prediction, if all of this quantitation is correct, the prediction is the mouse shouldn't feel it. And we knew that was a very gratifying point, actually. And I almost had to think a little bit about Faraday with this, because we knew that all along, okay? And Hans Reimer, my colleague, with whom we discussed all of this and who really produced these fantastic data, he understood it very quickly, that this would be the experiment to do. But we sort of tried to write a paper and do more controlled experiments and all sorts of stuff while actually doing this stem cell ablation requires another transgenic mouse, so it's a lot of work again, okay? And at some point when we already had written the manuscript, we knew that for about a year that this would be the right prediction. Hans Reimer came back from a seminar he gave in Dresden, and there's a group by a very good immunologist called Axel Wörs, and he also happens to be interested in stem cells, and he actually had done the experiment. He hadn't told anyone yet. It wasn't published. It's still not published for unclear reasons. Referees make problems. But he did this experiment, and our stuff was also not published at the time, and the result is the mouse has no phenotype in the blood. So you can actually selectively kill the stem cells, and the mouse is fine. Okay? And we really hope that this is coming out quite soon. And you ask yourself now, why do you need your stem cells? And this gets a little bit further now, of course. I should say the mouse is fine under most conditions. So it's fine when it's normally sitting in its cage. And of course, our mice are pampered, and they have pathogen-free environments and so on. It still remains fine if you challenge the mouse with certain kind of challenges in the periphery. But you can challenge it very heavily and really put the hematopoietic system under great stress. And in these situations, the mice actually fail to function very well. So there is clearly some role also for stem cells under some conditions.
And in the safe, stable conditions, for how long do they feel okay?
So a mouse lives 2 years or 2.5. And from our theory, that would last probably for almost the lifetime of the mouse.
Okay,
so these time scales.
The real experiments of...
The real experiments, I have to look it up, but I think they look for 5 months or something like this. So that's, given the lifetime of the mouse, a very sizable time span.
With a young adult, though.
You start with a young adult and then you wait until you go on.
So, my question is, say you differentiate from A to B, mm-hmm. right? Then you have to wait for an entire cycle before you can go to C. I mean, a different way of saying that these cascade equations have no time delay. Essentially, the second, right, that you label the top thing, you should start accumulating not a year after, right? But where is the time delay?
Ah, okay. So the question is, what does the dynamics look like? Yeah, of course, the dynamics look like exactly as you would expect from the equation. In principle, there should be something like this, okay, with some characteristic time here. It's a tall, this is your first compartment. It would be the label frequencies in the short-term stem cells. And if you look in detail, what it really looks is something like this. Okay, and this is interesting, and it's something we study further now. But moreover, overall, you conform to this picture, actually, of the compartment.
Okay, I think
so. It doesn't look like this. Okay, so it's not that there's a fixed delay. The theory is in some sense, in this average sense, it seems quite correct, actually.
Okay, so why do you say, you mean the year you like have, you know.
Exactly, it's a time constant of the system, like you would define a time constant.
Okay, so essentially that also means that there is, you can keep going, right? If you're differentiating, you can keep going, you don't have to wait at any point.
Exactly. Of course, there is experimental problem. There's experimental questions here. How do you evaluate the experimental error? So, but I would say the data are sufficient to actually say what you say. So there's no real strong fixed delays to go through this cascade, as we say here. So, I mean, just assuming these exponential waiting time distributions seems to be fine and fully in accord with the data that we have so far.
The thing is, it's quite difficult to answer that question because when you do the labeling, the time to the various cells that you've labeled, you don't know. So, I mean, it's not that you've got all the cells exactly in time, synchronized.
Absolutely.
So it's very hard to say whether there is a delay, a necessary delay, before you can differentiate or not.
So what Benny says is, of course, correct. But in this system, there's a big separation of timescales. So we label for a couple of days, and we observed the characteristic time of label accumulations a year in this compartment. So I think there are delays, but they're insignificant compared with the overall time scale.
Let's pause for a minute. Thank you. Let me ask someone to ask a question not from the program.
In order to produce a useful immunological response, the system has to modify itself. And I don't know if you said anything about how the system does modify itself.
Okay. So first of all, I should say, maybe I gave the wrong impression. Because for time constraints, I never got to the useful immunological part. Just that there's no... That you don't go home and think, I need to wait a year before sort of my viruses. However, just anecdotally, if you go to a doctor, and some people have things that are called bone marrow failure, so they produce too little of the cells that come out of the bone marrow, and a doctor usually looks for an infection that was in the recent past, okay, that may be a reason. What we would say, the doctor should look for an infection that's a year ago, okay, in some sense. So there is some relation with this, but of course the immune system has different rules, and that would be, I guess, another talk. The system does modify itself also in terms of when you have a strong bacterial infection, you use up a lot of these cells, and you need to start producing these cells. And the general idea is, of course, that there is negative feedback in the following sense. And I mean, just to what we think we know, there's this derived cell type, say Z here. And here's a progenitor, and here's Y. And somehow the number Z inhibits the production of a signal, and this signal activates processes that are further on this side. And I think this is probably the agreed scheme. But in terms of its real quantitative details, we know bloody little of what's really going on.
The way you drew differentiation is only like down the line, but can it also go up?
Ah, yeah, that's another important point. So in hematopoiesis, there's no evidence that there's plasticity in terms of producing stem cells from further derived cells. In other stem cell systems, there is. And there's no principal reason why it shouldn't.
You have this sort of extended sorry, you're you have this slope process, and yet in a sort of after birth, you have these cells, right?
Right.
So so the kind of extent of the the feedback must be enormous, right?
I think so, but and of course the experimental observation is there in the fetus is much faster, but in real quantitative numbers it has been very difficult to interpret actually so far. But I'm sure in a couple of years we know more because it's several.
The evidence on the shift from, so that the common myeloid progenitor is really producing throughout the time span always more than the lymphoid. Is that so? In some sense, if you think about the downstream, there is way more granulocytes than any other cell in the body, and that actually lasts throughout development. So, but you're seeing this essentially in the rate of so. The only alternative to this would be that the rate of CMPs self-renewal and differentiation would be much higher than CLPs.
So what we see is that, let's also be precise on this, what we see that what comes into CMPs from the stem cells eventually, and compared to what comes into the CLPs is much higher, okay? What we cannot distinguish at the moment with the data we have is the scenario that you sketched. It could be that there's a common precursor that just gives rise with different ratios to A and B or lymphoid and myeloid here, okay? And you ask yourself, how would the molecular system regulate this in a 100-to-1 ratio? It'd be very interesting. But it could also be, and we think it actually is, that there are branches that are already very early somehow. And it's really a little bit unclear. And there's progenitors down here, say, and then they will eventually give rise to the myeloid lineage. And maybe they will give rise to the lymphoid lineage. And there's a lot of selective proliferation in this branch as well. And that's something we cannot tell apart with the data we have so far. So it's very clear that these rates we observe in the system vary over two orders of magnitude, but it's not entirely clear which rates these are in detail. And of course, how this is molecularly regulated, I would say, is entirely unclear.